All right, friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network USA, irishradio.com, worldwide. I'm delighted to welcome a friend, and he is the executive editor. He is the top dog. He has the main key for the door of the Irish Echo newspaper, the oldest, the largest newspaper. Ray O'Hanlon, the Irish Echo was around even, it's older than you, isn't it?
Good morning, Adrian. Yes, it is considerably older than I am, although, I'm a journalist, so maybe I'm prone to a little exaggeration.
And you too, that's not right.
Yeah. I always say the Echo is the same age as the Oscars, 1928.
Wow. Is that mm-hmm. Korea?
Yeah. October 1928 was the birth of the Echo.
Wow. Okay. There you are. I probably knew that and forgot, but you know how it is yourself when you climb up there. Listen, I want to ask you, in the midst of all the earth-shattering negative news that we have in the world today and in the United States in particular with the pandemic and all the shuffle with respect to the presidential election. We were generally, at least anyway, of the assumption that we Irish and Irish Americans were all set with Brexit. On the way out the door, that was it. Deal done. Mm-hmm. No border. No more trouble. Mm-hmm. Nada. And then, what a hell of a week in Northern Ireland. What's the bottom line here? If we had to back up, okay, was that premature for us to say, hooray, it's all over?
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, no, the thing I think, Adrian, we've all got to remember is Brexit is not like Christmas Day, one and done, and then we move on. Brexit is a process, and the effect of Brexit will be continuous for years. And initially, I suppose, everybody was breathing a sigh of relief when there was an agreement on what we call the Northern Ireland Protocol, the Border Protocol, which would mean that there'd be no hard border in the island of Ireland. But what this necessitated was a kind of a barrier, a border in the Irish Sea between Britain and Northern Ireland, so that Northern Ireland would remain in terms of economic customs and standards purposes within the EU orbit, though still constitutionally in the United Kingdom. Sort of an economic link with Europe, but a constitutional link with the rest of the United Kingdom, with Great Britain across the water. And this is a very odd and unusual. We used to have the saying, if you remember back a few decades ago, an Irish solution for an Irish problem. That wasn't necessarily a flattering remark. And in a sense, we have, a European solution for a British-Irish problem. And it's a tricky one. And as we've seen in the last few days, it can be very tricky, particularly in the context of COVID-19, which is a sort of an X factor, an additional factor in all this. And this led to the sort of the brouhaha over the protocols and Europe seemingly forgetting what it had agreed with the UK and Brussels sort of not looking too quite up to speed. So, yes, the last few days have been a reason to sort of furrow our eyebrows.
Ray, what is this? Could this have been, expected? I know that you saw it coming in varied degrees. But what is the let's just zero in on the problem at the ports. And mm-hmm. something that was taken very seriously, they closed down the the ports for a day or two until they got something sorted out. But if it is the resurgence those who opposed the terms of the Brexit in the first place, not the least of which is First Minister Arlene Foster. Now what? Who's going to set up the barrier?
Right. Well, there's two dynamics, the different dynamics in play here. If you talk about the border protocol and the effect on concern over vaccines, and that led to the situation where Brussels invoked Article 16. It was almost as if they imagined some sort of stash of vaccines, pick a county in the Republic, let's say Cavan. And there was a stash of vaccines in Cavan, and they'd be going over the border into Northern Ireland out of the European Union. And, of course, the EU has been seen to be rather slow in approving vaccines and getting them out compared to the United Kingdom, which has been much, much faster and quicker out of the blocks. But, of course, there was no stash of vaccines in Cavan going to go into Northern Ireland. Most of the vaccines coming into Northern Ireland, pretty well all of them, are coming from Britain next door. I'm assuming they kind of leap over the border protocols because they're not merchandise for sale or anything like that. We're not talking about sausages and rashers here.
Yeah.
This invoking of Article 16 by Brussels, seemed to forget what Brussels itself had agreed with the United Kingdom with regards to there being no hard land border in the island of Ireland. But the implication of that was the border in the Irish Sea. And then subsequent to all this, you had Boris Johnson suggesting that he'd invoke Article 16 to get rid of the border in the Irish Sea, which it's a bit like whack-a-mole, which would actually bend to the border coming back up on the land. So this can go back and forth. But Brussels dropping the ball, and this certainly gave critics of the protocol, not least Arlene Foster, an opening. Here was Europe sort of making a mess of things. This doesn't work. We should get rid of it. She sees on that. But separate to that, the political argument, which you have to concede is legitimate, you can argue back and forth on this. But separate to that, there's the other issue, the security issue of port workers in Belfast and Larne in County Antrim being threatened by loyalists, because these port workers are applying the EU regulations to goods coming in from Britain. And this problem and the early teething problems has led to literally bare supermarket shelves in Northern Ireland. But this is another matter altogether, where workers have been threatened by loyalist paramilitaries, who, of course, then, are probably inspired by this sort of political chaos. And certainly encouraged by it. So you have issues and problems at different levels, and it clearly has to be sorted out. When you have a situation where Belfast, Dublin, and London are all directing their ire at Brussels, you know something is up. Something is not working. So clearly they're going to have to sort out the snags in this whole procedure.
So, speaking of taking advantage of opportunity, there's some irony in the fact that the EU is actually screwing up. We were up and down the road with that one for a long time, and then saying, well, they're going to pull up their socks as well. How did they actually allow this to happen? Where was the weak link with the European Union and with respect to this?
Yeah, well, it seems to come back to just literally vaccine supply. The European Union, as you know, was involved in something of a row with AstraZeneca, which developed the vaccine with Oxford University. I suppose in part because it was being partly developed in Oxford, AstraZeneca, I believe, is actually a Swedish company, but of course companies are everywhere, that the UK was just much quicker in approving AstraZeneca, Oxford, and ordering large quantities of it, and the EU was slow. So the EU reacted to this. I mean, you can imagine there's a lot of political fallout in the bloc, in the European Union, in individual countries, and people getting angry and frustrated. And they're all looking to Brussels and saying, you know, you're mishandling this. Do something. And then the EU, you know, they're looking at the Republic of Ireland as part of the EU, and Northern Ireland as not being part of the EU, which it is, as I said, for sausages and rashers. But all of a sudden, you know, looking at it as being something entirely separate in terms of vaccines. So they were getting their X's and Y's crossed here, you know, and really obviously didn't look closely at the nuances, at the political implications of suddenly saying, oh, you know, we're erecting a barrier now between the Republic and Northern Ireland. So it was a lack of insight and foresight and study on the part of the EU and the Commission and President Ursula von der Leyen really looked rather foolish. Now, she has apologized. Yes, I'm sure we can move on from this, but quite clearly they need to get their ducks in a row.
Yeah, and, you know, even after the apology, there is a security issue at the ports and, you know, so who's in charge of the hen house here? You know, if you have your buddy Bruce Morrison of Morrison Visa fame. In speaking with Bruce Morrison, and I know you know you're cagey enough to take people off guard. I know that firsthand. But last week, even before the Irish Echo collaborated with the Hibernians, Ancient Order of Hibernians, to appoint a U.S. special envoy to Ireland now, as opposed to down the road. You sussed out somebody who many people, at least a majority of people, would probably agree that definitely in the top 10 of, you know, potential envoys to Northern Ireland would be former Congressman Bruce Morrison. Why, and when we read it a week ago, it's like saying, why the rush? If you're going to do that, then why don't you appoint, you know, or why Biden doesn't appoint an ambassador to Ireland? One fell swoop, let that be it.
Yeah, I mean, I think ordinarily, if we were in a sort of a quiet time, that, you know, and given Biden's obvious Irishness and love of Ireland and all things Irish, that the appointment of an envoy and of a U.S. ambassador to Dublin would be something that would be announced on or around St. Patrick's Day. I think that's a fair expectation. You'd be kind of surprised if St. Patrick's Day came and went and nothing was said. There wouldn't be a new ambassador. And there wouldn't be an envoy to succeed Mick Mulvaney, who was President Trump's envoy. So that the continuity of the envoy position is clearly understood to be crucial. Now, whereas I suppose you could say you could wait until St. Patrick's Day for the announcement of an ambassador to succeed Edward Crawford, that would be fine because diplomatic relations between Ireland, the United States, and Dublin, you know, if there's an ambassador vacancy, is handled by the handled by the embassy anyway, which is staffed by professional diplomats, and there's no huge gap there in that sense. Now, the envoy position is something different, and I think given those events of recent days that we have been discussing, looms larger still now. And the question arises, can we wait till St. We're talking about well over a month. Can we wait until St. Patrick's Day to announce the envoy, the name of an envoy, and to publicly proclaim America's resolve and commitment as a guarantor of the Good Friday Agreement and effectively as a guarantor of the Northern Ireland Protocol, which has a serious implication for the Good Friday Agreement because the agreement provided for no hard border on the island of Ireland, as does the protocol. But if you get rid of the protocol, you have a hard border, and then you damage the Good Friday Agreement. And this is where we're at now. So can we wait weeks for the naming of an envoy? Well, I think the argument out there, and certainly in this petition, which involves the ECHO and the Hibernians, would seem to suggest that no, we cannot wait. And additionally, on top of that, we do have Bruce Morrison saying that he's ready to serve. This is a rare thing, actually, that you actually get somebody coming out and saying this, that I've never really heard this before, coming out and saying, if I'm asked, I will serve. So he is planting his flag out there, and he says, I'm ready. And I think everybody would agree that there would be few individuals more versed in the nuances and the pitfalls of Northern Ireland politics than Bruce Morrison.
Yeah.
He would be an outstanding choice for this job, and he's ready to do it. So why can't we say, okay, you're ready, pack your bags, get off on your first trip, and do it now.
Whose call is it? It's a rhetorical question, but whose call is it to take care of that swiftly? We know that with the ambassador positions, okay, you got to have hearings and everybody has to put their two cents in. Who appoints the envoy to Northern Ireland, and what are the strings or the hurdles to get over?
If you look at the history of the envoy, it's kind of a who you're representing. Various envoys, when you go back to George Mitchell, he was effectively representing President Clinton. The envoys over the years have seemingly represented the president or at times the Secretary of State. If you take Declan Kelly, for example, the Irish-born envoy who was crafted with or a task with a specific economic responsibilities because the politics was quiet at the time. So he was focusing on economics, on jobs effectively in Northern Ireland. But he was answering directly to Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State. You have the likes of Richard Haass, So you have it's a question, is the envoy representing the Secretary of State or the President? I mean, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter because the envoy is representing the United States. So whether the appointment comes directly from the Oval Office or Foggy Bottom, the Department of State, who knows? Will it be Antony Blinken saying, you're the envoy, or will it be President Biden saying, you're the envoy? Does it really matter at the end of the day? One or t'other, they have to sort that out. And I'd imagine that President Biden has this circulating in his head, and he would have mentioned it to his Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, who has now been confirmed in his office. Who knows? Does it matter at the end of the day? No. You carry you represent the United States, whether your immediate boss is the Secretary of State or the President. Ultimately, it's the President, regardless. So who knows?
And now, we haven't had historically any pushback with envoys that have been appointed to Northern Ireland by factions, whether that's a Catholic, Protestant, or nationalist, unionist. You think that will hold, or do you think that if a Bruce Morrison were to be appointed, maybe the unionists would say, well, that fella is actually, he's very pro Southern Ireland, and he proved so by, fighting like hell and having success with the Morrison visas, which, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you want to get down to that sort of old-time religion stuff, Irish context, Bruce Morrison's Irish origins are in County Fermanagh, and he's a Protestant. So you can knock that one out the window. In fact, if you go to Wikipedia, you see him as being that he's Episcopalian, which would be the U.S. equivalent of the Church of Ireland or the Church of England, part of the Anglican Communion. But he isn't, actually. And he reminded me of this when we spoke recently. He's actually a Lutheran and proud of it. So I kind of joked with him, well, the first thing if you're appointed envoy you might have to do is to fly to London and hammer in the Good Friday Agreement and the Northern Ireland border protocols on the door of number 10 Downing Street, as a good Lutheran that you are. I think given Bruce Morrison's involvement in the early days of the peace process, his long-term commitment, his knowledge and everything, it'd be very, very hard for anybody in Northern Ireland politics to openly object. There are some, certainly, in unionism and in loyalism in particular, who object to U.S. interference or involvement, and there'll be complaints and everything else. But the vast majority of people in Northern Ireland, both communities, everybody, recognize how vital the input of the United States has been for peace and prosperity, going back to George Mitchell, going back to President Clinton, and would accept the U.S. role as a guarantor. And if it is Bruce Morrison, I mean, his brief will be slightly widened this thing at the time, because you expect envoys to pay visits to Belfast, Dublin, and London. He might have to add Brussels, actually, this time around, just to make sure that Europe realizes that the United States, as Joe Biden keeps saying, America is back. And that he says, well, we're back here, too, in the context of our role as guarantor of the peace and political process in Ireland.
Ray O'Hanlon, most of us who've been around for decades associate, the weekly newspapers, the Irish Echo, the Irish Voice, Irish Examiner, and going back long enough to, the Irish World, the Irish Advocate, as a weekly newspaper, and you look forward to Wednesdays when you went to the newsstand and you pick it up. There was a particular, including myself, you get a particular joy of actually going to the newsstand, picking it up, and and the getting it by mail, even if it comes, a day later, for some. It's not the same. However, the Irish Echo or the Irish newspapers are. This is not unique to the newspaper. I mean, the newspapers are going through hell in terms of people. First of all, the distribution and which ones carry whatever. Did that, in a way, prompt, say, the Irish Echo? To not have us wait until Wednesday to pick up the newspaper or for the online.
I balance this every week. Some people still, it's vital that they see something in print, even if they've seen it online. It ain't real till they see it in print. And you'd be surprised that some of the people you'd think would be younger and technologically so savvy and everything else still... There's something about seeing it in print. And then, for example, if you're talking about an obituary, example, people still want to see that in print. So we kind of have this balancing act, and yet the news never stops. It's a nonstop cycle. So we're loading stuff online all the time. Certain rules have evolved. For example, if we report a story online on Monday, say, but it's all, does it go into the, not everything goes into the print now. Some things are uniquely online. Some things are uniquely print. Some are both. If something is online on Monday, what generally will happen, it'll be deeper into the paper on Wednesday.
Okay.
It'll lose some of its, it'll be there, but it'll be further, because we'll be looking for newer stuff to front load the print edition. So there's this sort of balancing act that goes on all the time. And then you have your daily news lines and your social media and your whatnot. So even in the context of Irish America, of the Irish newspapers, there's something new there for you pretty well every day now.
Every day,
So it's a daily thing now. My early days in this business, I worked as a daily and an evening newspaper.
Sure did.
Daily journalism and everything else. And then
in Dublin,
the Echo was in Dublin, And then the Echo, when I came here, I had to switch into a sort of a weekly mode and time frame. But that's gone. I'm back to sort of a daily thing now with a weekly. It's a bit like a spike chart, with Wednesday being the sort of the high spike, because it's a double it's both on that day. So different decisions have to be made, different priorities. But, it means that people are getting more than they were getting. And whenever it's there and that we're essentially, if we're not physically working 7 days a week, we're certainly mentally working 7 days a week. Yeah. It never stops, it's a good thing if we're very busy. And obviously because of COVID, working remotely is a whole new thing as well. But for some people, many people, and as I say, not all necessarily older readers, but some people still want to get that thing in their hand.
I think we have a couple around here. They're getting a little brown now, and from January of last year. Show me that. No, there is something to that. A reality that affects us in Irish Radio, the Irish Echo, all of the newspapers, Irish American Magazine, Irish Central, is through these times, there is a kind of an expectation that all of the sponsorship and the funding and everything, well, what the hell, that's what they're supposed to be doing anyway, without regard for, who's picking up the freight here. It's, mm-hmm. it's a particular problem that, I think it's no harm to let people know that we're not a given. We're not going to be on air. We're not going to be, entitled to, in the case of the Echo or Irish Central, daily up to the minute news and hard news, unless the money comes from somewhere.
Yes. It all boils down to that. There was a story in the Irish Times during the week about calls, and this has been repeated over the years, and this is specifically in Ireland, that the Irish government needs to step up and help support Irish media in Ireland because of the public service aspect of it. A number of European countries do that, Scandinavian countries in particular. Whereas you look at Ireland, the media there, let's say the print media, you're kind of hammered three ways. You don't get any sort of government subsidy. What you do get is VAT, value-added tax on your product, which is actually a kick in the transom. Also, for example, you're up against extraordinarily harsh libel laws, so it restricts your ability to work in some circumstances and can be enormously costly if you're sued and so forth and so on. So. Yeah. The media, the print media in Ireland in particular, is kind of swimming against a combined tide. And certainly, if government took an enlightened view of what media actually does in a democratic society and the importance of it and realized the pressures. In the United States, in the last two decades or something, we have lost about 2,000 mostly local newspapers. They die every day. The Washington Post has its little, motto on the top, democracy dies in darkness. Democracy dies because of a lack of free media as well. And so this, I think, is something that needs to be looked at by both the community has to be aware of this, of the challenges being faced of a media that they perhaps took for granted for very many years. And it has to be looked at. Governments. And let's face it, politicians get mostly reams of positive publicity from media. If they trip up, they get criticized and maybe attacked. But for the most part, they it's like a free lunch on a rolling basis. I think going back to Ireland and it would come across the ocean to the Irish American media as well, because it's something that has to be looked at very seriously in the long term view.
Okay, you've pretty much spelled it out there, and that's the reality. But coming back to your collaboration and the new impetus to just not wait around for, you know, President Joe Biden to get around to, you know, appointing a special envoy to Northern Ireland. There's a very serious and urgent petition that needs to be signed. I mean, there's no point in us sitting back, you know, throwing softballs into the air and hoping that they land, you know, on the Oval Office. What is the procedure for that, and what are we signing on to?
Well, I don't think we realize what the procedure is. It's been sort of, it's been sort of up and down. You know, that there have been gaps in the envoy position over the years, and it's not like something that's done the first day when all ambassadors, politically appointed ambassadors, automatically resign. And then there's a period, an interregnum, and there's a period before they're replaced, where the professional diplomats take over the envoy. There have been large gaps in the envoy job. I mean, Mick Mulvaney came in the final year of the Trump administration, not the first. So there was a huge gap there. Better late than never, absolutely. But we shouldn't have to be waiting that sort of length of time at all, and particularly given recent current circumstances, for an appointment of a replacement for Mick Mulvaney. And I think what the petition is doing is saying that it's, you know, we need it now, next few days. Don't wait. Name somebody. Send a signal. We're back. Yes, we're back. America's back in this specific context. Let's do it.
Ray O'Hanlon, again, Boston executive editor, and he who only works 7 days a week. I don't know if there were 8 days. Yeah. Thanks,
Mayor. That was the Beatles. 8 days a week.
All right. Thank you, my friend. All right.
Thank you, Adrian.
Thanks. God bless. All right. Bye. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USAIrishRadio.com, worldwide.